Thank you, Leonard, for the prayer. As he said, we are thankful for your presence, especially any that are visiting. We are glad that you chose to be with us and invite you to come back anytime that you have the opportunity to be here. We're going to continue our study this evening in the divided kingdom. We had gotten to question 11 in our class material in lesson 4, but I want to take a few moments to kind of go back a little bit because we were right in the middle of the Mount Carmel scene as we got to the end of the last class. So I want to go back and hit a few things that I've come to think of over the past few days, and then we'll build back up into the scene that takes place on Mount Carmel as we continue on with our study. But let's kind of step back a little bit, and I want to go back to Obadiah, the prophet that came out the prophet that came out to try to find grass for the animals. And he met Elijah. We talked a little bit about Obadiah and what he did, but I wanted to kind of compare him to maybe even Daniel and his position. I mean, what was the position that Obadiah held in Ahab's kingdom? What was he over? He's over his household. Of course, we know from what we've studied already about Ahab, Ahab was a very nasty man, brought in some really bad things for the nation of Israel. But Obadiah found a way to impress Ahab enough that he was able to be in his household and rule over it. And Obadiah, as we know, was a God-fearing man because it tells us he greatly feared the Lord. And he even tells us that he hid 50 prophets, 50 here, 50 there, a total of 100, because Jezebel had killed a bunch of them. So he wanted to protect them. So he actually went out of his way with a wicked king and a wicked queen to be able to protect those prophets. And what did he provide for them? Food and water at a time of a drought, after there had been a drought for 3 years. So it was not a small task that he did, but Obadiah was a servant. He feared God. He was a servant to other men because he took them and hid them and took care of them. And I believe it's very important for us to see these people as we go through these studies, to see what they did, what they went through, what steps they took and what measures they took to do service for the Lord. Even though the situation was not ideal. Daniel did a very similar thing, taken into captivity. He was put into the service of the king. But Daniel was a godly man and he feared the Lord and he served God. It can be done. So I think for us, we need to look at these kind of people and we need to say, hey, what can we learn from them for us? I'm sure that not all of us live in an ideal work environment. I know I don't. Even though I do work at home, I have to talk to people, and those conversations sometimes are not pleasant. We have to deal with the world. Obadiah was dealing with a king that was nasty and terrible in his reign, but yet he figured out a way to serve God and serve him well. So I wanted to kind of go back and talk a little bit about Obadiah. Anybody have anything they want to add to that? All right, so Obadiah, of course, Ahab says, go here, go there, let's find some grass to feed the animals. He meets Elijah. Elijah says, hey, you know, I'm coming to see the king. Go tell him. And of course, Obadiah is just frantic. You're kidding me, right? Because I'm going to go tell him you're here and you're going to go away and you're not going to be found. And regardless, Elijah says, as the Lord of hosts, this is verse 15 of chapter 18. I love the way Elijah puts this. As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand. That's great faith there. I will surely show myself to him today. He put the word of the Lord to Obadiah saying, I, in the name of the Lord, will be there. So Obadiah believes him and goes and gets Ahab. Of course, we talked about the interaction that Ahab has with Elijah whenever they meet. And of course, he calls him the troubler of Israel. And of course, Elijah turned and says, I haven't troubled Israel. You have. And why had Ahab troubled Israel so bad? What was the reason given by Elijah? Put the Lord aside. Put the Lord aside and brought in a worship that was heinous to the Lord. So Elijah proceeds to, of course, the drought's still going on. Remember that. So Elijah proceeds to say, okay, how long are we going to call upon two gods? We got to decide. Kind of reminds me of what Joshua says. You know, you going to serve the gods of the Amorites in your house, or are you going to serve the Lord? We see the same thing here from Elijah. Who are you going to serve? And of course, there's no answer from the people because they're torn. And remember, there are some people serving the Lord, but there's a lot serving Baal at this time as well. So Elijah says, bring in all the prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of the Asherah that eat at the table of Jezebel. We're going to have a challenge here. And as we see from question 11, as we talked about last week, or last Sunday, that was this week. As we talked about this challenge, he says, okay, you've got a whole bunch of you guys over here, 450 prophets of Baal. You take a cow, an oxen, I'm going to take an oxen, and we're going to do this. We're going to sacrifice it to our God, but we're not going to put any fire under it. And he tells them, you guys go first. There's a bunch of you, so you guys go first. He gave them that option. And of course, the people are like, hey, this is a good idea. This is a great idea. Let's do this. Yes. All right. So prophets of Baal get together. They sacrifice their, they cut up their oxen. They build the altar. They put the wood on it. And what do they start doing in the morning, that morning after they get everything prepared? Hollering for Baal. Oh, Baal, where are you? Oh, Baal, come, start this fire. Whatever words they were using. They were calling to their God. And they do this from morning until noon. And as soon as noontime comes, what does Elijah start doing? Starts mocking them. Maybe your God's not listening. Maybe your God's asleep. Maybe he's on a journey. Maybe he just needs to cry louder. So that's what they do. They take these things from Elijah and they start crying louder. They get to a point where they start cutting themselves with knives and swords as part of the worship that they would do to Baal. And they're calling on Baal to come, and they're calling. Their blood's gushing out of them. It's a terrible scene. But the time for the evening sacrifice comes, and what kind of response do they get? Absolutely nothing. Silence. No one answered. No one said anything. No one paid attention. Baal was not there. Why was Baal not there? Because he didn't exist. He wasn't a true God. So now Elijah says, okay, it's my turn. Gather all of Israel to me. So Elijah gets them all there. He rebuilds the altar, takes 12 stones, which represents the 12 tribes of Israel, as we see in the old law. How it was to be set up. Uncut, unhewn stones. He put wood on it. He put the stones in place. He cut up the oxen. He even built a trench around the altar so that he could use it for a purpose. But he didn't put a fire under it. And what was the next thing that he asked for these people to do after he put all this in place? Okay, how many times? Poured water on it. Okay, he arranged in verse 33 of chapter 18. So he arranged the wood and cut the oxen in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, fill four pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood. He said, do it a second time. He said, do it a second time. And they did it a second time. And he said, do it a third time. And they did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and he also filled the trench with water. We talked about this Sunday. What was the purpose for putting the water on the sacrifice? And the wood. And the dirt. Filling the trench. Elijah was about to make a statement through God. He was going to make a statement to the people because he told them, whoever consumes this sacrifice, he is God. And he wants to make that point loud and clear. So he's gone to this point of getting the sacrifice wet to where, you know, anybody that camps knows wet wood does not burn. This was not going to burn without something supernatural, as Stan just said.
It removed any sleight of hand, magician type thing.
Right. Removed anything that could have pulled the wool over their eyes, so to speak. This was going to be a true act of God that the people would see. So Elijah, at this time, when all the water's poured on, begin in verse 36. At the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are God in Israel, and I am your servant, and I have done all these things at your word. Note, God gave him instruction. This was to show that God was the God. He did exactly what God had told him to do. Verse 37, answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and you have turned their hearts back again. Verse 38, just picture the scene in your head as you think about this scene taking place. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering, the wood, the stones, the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. So we're looking at this altar with the sacrifice, the wood, the water, the trench, the dust. God consumes it all. Nothing left. Pretty amazing scene to think about. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. It took this act, this miracle, this challenge for the people to understand and see that God was truly God. Because Baal didn't do it. And that's the whole point of this challenge, was for Elijah, for the people to see God was the true God. Any questions or comments to this point?
I was looking up at the Mount Rock. It would take something like 1,100 degrees. That would also take out some of the people around it. This is probably something else that God controls as well. And that kind of heat would melt rock and not kill the people around it.
Yes. Extremely precise. I mean, that's why this story is so amazing to think about how it went about, because he did gather the people there. But you're right, it doesn't say anything about anybody being consumed by this fire. Only the sacrifice and the things that were supposed to be consumed were consumed. So as the challenge is over, the people are bowing down. They're saying, God is God. Elijah says, okay, go seize the 450 prophets of Baal. Now, it's evident from what happens here. I mean, 450 people, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people to try to round up after this great event. But he says, don't let a single one escape. And they don't. So what does that tell you about the people?
They were believing and they were following and probably were the ones that did the execution as well. I doubt that he did 450 of them by himself.
Yeah, that would take a while, but you're right. I mean, the people believed. The people's hearts were turned at that time to the Lord. And that's what Elijah had prayed for, that they would their hearts would be turned back to him again. And it was at this point in time, because they, in my mind, they apparently helped gather these 450 people and likely helped execute them when they were taken down to the brook. So these 450 prophets of Baal are taken, they're executed, they're gotten rid of. Again, an act by Elijah to try and rid the nation of Israel of this false prophet, of this false idol. And of course, what does Ahab go and do? Shortly after this, who's he run to? We got another story to talk about before he goes and talks to her, but he runs home to Jezebel. And then we're going to see some events that take place after that. But now remember, all this has happened and we're still in a drought. And what had Elijah been coming back to do when he originally met with Ahab? He's coming back to say there's going to be rain coming. So as soon as this challenge is over, he tells Ahab, hey, you go up and you go eat and drink. So Ahab goes. Elijah decides that he's going to go up on the mountain as well. And he goes and he sits down and he puts his head between his knees. And he tells his servant to go and do what? What's that?
Look towards the sea.
And what does he see? Nothing. Then he tells him to do what? Go look again 7 times. This is not going to be a, okay, I'm going to go and it's there. He had to go and look 7 more times. Now, Elijah, no doubt, was praying during this time for the rain to come, because that was the purpose of the servant going and looking over the sea. And the 7th time, what does the servant come back and tell him? About the size of a man's fist or hand coming up over the sea. So he tells him, okay, go tell Ahab you better get on your chariot and you better get out of here, because the rain's coming. And it doesn't need to slow you down, because apparently it was going to be a pretty big, heavy rain, because it was going to bog the chariots down. Because you might imagine everything was dust anyway, because there was no grass. So it'd be a big mud hole when the rain came. So we see Ahab rides off and Elijah is getting ready to come down, and Elijah ends up picking up with the help of the Lord and running ahead of Ahab, heading back to Jezreel. So that's where they're at, because that's where Jezebel is as well. So the rain comes. That 3.5 years that we hear about in James, the end of that drought has taken place. And so now we see everybody is going back to Jezreel at this point. So any questions or comments up to this point in our lesson? All right. So when he gets back to Jezreel, of course, Ahab goes and tells Jezebel everything that happened. What's Jezebel's response? Okay, so this time tomorrow, the same thing is going to happen to you. You're going to be killed, just like those prophets of mine were killed. And, of course, what's Elijah's take on that? Somebody comes to tell you that you're going to be killed tomorrow, what's going to be your take on it? Fear. Not going to be very, very good news to hear. And Elijah has just gone in. He feels like he's the only prophet of the Lord, because all these other, I mean, it was him versus 450 false prophets, plus 400 prophets of the Asherah. I mean, that was him versus 850 guys. That's pretty drastic odds there. But when Elijah hears about this, he decides he's going to run away. So he leaves and takes a day's journey into the wilderness. And what happens when he is in the wilderness? Question 13. How was Elijah provided for before his journey? Right.
So he's gone a long way, and then he leaves the servant and goes and
He's out in the boonies. He's down in the very southern part of the nation or the land of Judah, and he's fleeing for his life. And what does he ask for while he's there in the wilderness? He asked the Lord to take his life. He wants to die because I'm the only one left. I'm not any better than my fathers. Take me now. So Elijah, great prophet of the Lord, hit a point in his life, hit a low point in his life. And do we all kind of hit those points in our lives? And sometimes we may want things that we really don't want in those situations, like what Elijah wanted. Elijah wanted the Lord to take his life. He felt like he was alone. But we're going to see that God had a different plan for Elijah. So before he ends up taking this great journey, how does he get provided for? Okay, so here's Elijah praying for God to take his life. And who does God send to him? An angel. An angel's giving him water and giving him food. And he's asleep. The angel touches him, wakes him up, eat. He goes back to sleep. Angel comes again, touches him, eat. The journey's too great for you. Because Elijah had a plan to go to Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. And the angel knew he needed the strength of this food, because how long did he go without food? 40 days. 40 days. That's a long time. So he ends up going to the mountain of God, Mount Horeb, which is the same mountain as Mount Sinai. And that's where he goes and gets in a cave. Now, one of the things that I ask here is, why did Elijah plead with God to take his life? We kind of already talked about it a little bit, but I want to get some feedback from you. Why do you think Elijah was pleading to God to take his life? Okay. To me, you have to look at what just happened. Here, as I said, he, one man versus 850. That's like going to battle against an army that you know you can't beat. So, yeah, I can see totally how Elijah felt like he was alone, because he was the only one there. Even when he said, serve God or serve Baal, there was no answer. Nobody stood with him to serve the Lord. So, yes, Elijah pleaded with God to take his life. The other part of that is, how did God answer him? Well, we'll see that as we look through the story here in chapter 19, beginning in verse 9. So let's kind of read through this as to what happens while he's at Mount Horeb. He came there to a cave, and he lodged there. And it's verse 9 of chapter 19. The word of the Lord came to him and said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? That's how God interacted with him immediately. What are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed the prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Elijah feels like he's at his last leg. So God says, all right, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. So we know the Lord's coming by. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountain, breaking into pieces. The rocks before the Lord. Great wind. Now you can imagine what Elijah was thinking when this great wind's coming and the rocks are breaking. It's pretty intense scene. But what does it say about the Lord? He wasn't in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake. Imagine the mountain shaking. Not the first time that mountain shaking. Mountain shaking. But again, the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. I love this. And then the sound of a gentle blowing. Now you can imagine, here's Elijah in his cave. All this is taking place. He's probably trembling from fear and fright. But then all of a sudden there's a gentle blowing. So what does Elijah do? He comes out. He comes out, wraps his face in the mantle, and when he stood at the entrance of the cave, behold, a voice came to him and said, again, what are you doing here, Elijah? God asked him the same question he asked him the first time. And it's very interesting. Elijah answers the exact same way. I've been very zealous for the Lord, the God of Israel, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left. They seek my life to take it away. The Lord said, go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And then he gives him other things to take care of at this point. So, next question is, who does he pick to take his place? Okay, Elisha. So, picture this now. Here's Elijah wanting his life to be taken, thinking that he's going to be killed. God says, Elijah, you got work to do. And one of the things that you're going to do is you're going to pick your replacement. Because he's told, you're going to go pick Elisha to be the prophet of the Lord. Who else did Elijah get told he was going to have to deal with as he's leaving? Okay. So, two other things that the Lord says. Now, of course, you know the Lord is God of the children of Israel. But God also rules where? In the kingdom of men. So he chooses who's going to be the king of Syria or Aram. Depends on your translation. So God tells Elijah, you go and you pick Hazael to be the king of Syria. Not one of the children of Israel. He also says, you're going to pick Jehu to be king of Israel. But he also gives some more information about what these kings and what these men are going to do. What does he tell him about each one? Whoever escapes from the sword of Hazael, king of Syria, Jehu's going to kill. And whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha is going to kill. That's God's plan. He had these people picked to be in these positions for specific reasons. And we're going to see as the story continues how they do play a major role in things that go on with the children of Israel. All right, any questions or comments to this point? Right. So I think that's an excellent point. And we've had many sermons on this. When we're low in our life, when things get a little foggy, We get a little discouraged. Our faith may wane just a little bit. We can go back and look at these stories like this to build our hope, to build our confidence, to build our faith. Because like Sam said, I think I am much happier when I'm engaged in godly things. Life seems to be so much fuller. I'm happier. But when the world steps in, things of the world happen, it drags us down. So we need to do like these guys and put our confidence and faith fully in our God. Because the promises are there that God's made to us that we're going to have a great reward in the end for sure. May have some bumps along the way in our life, but we're going to be rewarded. God wasn't finished with Elijah. Even though Elijah was down at the lowest point he could be, wanting his life to be taken, God says, I'm not done with you. You got work to do. And he commissioned him to go do that work. And Elijah, being the prophet that he is, and we're going to see even in the New Testament, Elijah is very close to the Lord. He even is one of the ones that appears on the Mount Transfiguration. Elijah played a big part in the lives of the children of Israel, especially at this time when he's trying to help bring them back to the Lord. That was the goal. Any other comments? Well, when God commissions Elijah to do this, when God says, hey, you go and you anoint these kings, you get these people set in place, we see that God gives him another piece of information too. So what does he provide to Elijah before he returns to Damascus? What information does he provide that's helpful for Elijah? Very good. Here Elijah thinks he's alone, thinks he's the only one, says that to the Lord directly, and God says, you got work to do, and oh, by the way, there's 7,000 in Israel that have not bowed the knee to Baal, nor have they kissed him. Haven't had anything to do with him. You're not alone. So not only does God give Elijah this commission work to do, he gives him encouragement by saying, there are others. There are others that are following me and have not turned away. So that to me would be fantastic news to hear, to know that I'm not alone, especially if I was feeling that way. And that's what happened with Elijah, is he did not feel alone at this point, I don't think. When he found out there were 7,000 that had not bowed the knee to Baal. All right, and in the last few minutes, we'll talk about question 18. So Elijah comes back, and the first thing that he is going to do at the end of chapter 19 is he's going to interact with Elisha, the man that he's chosen, that God chose to replace him. Now, how does this interaction go with Elisha? What's Elisha doing?
He's plowing in the field with 12 pair of oxen.
Okay.
So Elijah goes to him with his bow guard and more or less
Yes. Okay. So very interesting interaction. Elijah sees Elisha plowing with oxen, puts his cloak, mantle, whatever he has, put it on him. And it's evident at that point, Elijah's like, this means something. Let me go say bye to my parents. Let me go kiss my father and my mother, and then I'll follow you. So he had to go take care of family business that he wanted to at the time. And I like Elijah's response. He said, go back again, for what have I done to you? All he did was just put the cloak on him. But not only does Elisha go back to kiss his parents, he sacrifices the oxen, feeds them, ministers, boils of flesh, implements of the oxen, gives it to the people. Apparently there's more than just his family. There's a group of people there. And they eat. And then he takes off and he goes and he ministers to Elijah. And we're going to see the interaction of Elisha and Elijah as we continue on with our story in this time of the divided kingdom. So Elisha has been picked by God, anointed in a way by Elijah to be the next prophet of the Lord. And we're going to see next Sunday when we pick up with lesson five, we're going to see what interaction continues between the two of them. And we'll see how things turn out for Elisha going forward. Any last minute questions or comments through this part of the lesson? Yeah, he knows his own. He knows his own, and we will have that reward as long as we stay faithful even to death. And I think that's the way Elijah felt. He was faithful to the Lord. So any other comments? Right, yeah. Kind of an interesting scenario there with that situation versus what Elisha does with his family is he goes back and he offers a sacrifice with his family, feeds them, and... Right. Yes, there are similarities. But Elijah, that's why I said about, it's interesting, go back again for what have I done to you? It's like, take care of your business and then we'll proceed on. Very interesting how Elijah deals with that request from Elisha. But we're going to see after the fact, Elisha is very close to Elijah, even to the point when Elijah is no longer on the earth. So I appreciate any other comments. I know we got about a minute left. Nope, we don't. So thank you very much for your time, for your comments and your attention, and we will pick up with lesson five beginning Sunday morning, Lord willing.